Welcome to the I3 podcast hosted by the Staff Development and Training Division of the South Carolina Department of Social Services. Our I3 podcast is a space where we as social service professionals can imagine, ideate, and discuss innovative ways to improve policy, practice, and the culture within our profession. If you have a passion for, or you feel called to serve others, then the I3 podcast is a place for you to learn, grow, and explore creative possibilities that could help improve the way in which you help others. With that said, I invite you to be present during our time together and allow your creative energy to flow as we discuss various topics in the field of social services. Hello, everyone. Again, this is your host, Dr. Gary James, and I'd like to welcome you to this episode of our I3 podcast. Today, we have an important and complex topic that we'd like to delve into during this episode, which is racial disparities and racial biases within the child welfare system and the impact that it has on children, youth, and families, those individuals and those families that we serve on a daily basis. Joining us for this discussion is the State Director of the South Carolina Department of Social Services, Mr. Mike Leach. I'm sure you remember Director Leach from our very first I3 episode, where he shared his thoughts on the necessity of being imaginative, creative, and innovative in our work within human services. We're also joined by our good friend and consultant from the Casey Foundation, Mr. Lyman Lectors. Lyman is, in my estimation, one of the foremost authorities on the subject of racial bias in child welfare, and he's a professional who brings a wealth of passion, experience, and wisdom related to racial disparities and biases within the system of care for children and youth. So, gentlemen, with that being said, welcome to I3.
Thanks, Dr. James.
Director Leach, Dr. James, good to see you both, and it's a privilege to be here with you.
Yes, sir. Privileged to have you both. So let's dive right in, gentlemen. When we talk about racial disparities within the child welfare system, we don't do that from an opinion standpoint we're thinking of. We do that from a data standpoint. So from your perspective, what do racial disparities look like based on national and local data? Director Leach, if you could kick us off, sir.
It is a complex topic. I'm glad we are discussing it. I do think awareness of this is important, just knowing that it's there, having the data so that we can look at what's driving it. I think it helps potentially down the road help with creating a commitment from stakeholders, everybody who's part of a child welfare system, to one, understand it and look for effective strategies to deal with it. Racial disparities within the child welfare system, it's a complex and concerning issue, and it has gained national attention over a long period of time. Now, at the same time, I still think it's fairly new. It's been there forever. The discussions around it are newer in the sense over the last couple decades. And then what people are doing about it, I think, is even newer. Studies have consistently shown that the children from racial and ethnic minority groups are overrepresented in the child welfare system. Lyman can probably speak more to sort of the national lens. From the South Carolina lens, there is disproportionality in reporting of Black and African-American children, in people calling our hotline, in the child welfare system screening in these cases. And we see there's a disproportionate amount of Hispanic children entering the foster care system. And we see in certain parts of the state, a disproportionate amount of Black teens being brought to care. If you look at it from a statewide lens versus a county lens, you can find these things and see them. I can tell you, though, that since we've started really looking at this, thinking about what we need to do, and we have seen a decrease, the rates of disparity still exist. And I think we have seen a decrease because we have set universal goals, targeted different things as far as trying to address some policies and procedures around this. And they still exist, and they still exist at different decision points. So we still have to drill deeper into figuring out what we need to do more of.
Totally agree. Lyman, from your perspective, what does it look like from a national lens?
Yeah, I think it's very similar. I mean, each jurisdiction has its own nuance, its own kind of regional dynamic. Nationally, we see across the country overrepresentation at every decision point, at the hotline call, decision to investigate, the decision to remove a child from their family, and subsequent decisions throughout the system. So doing decision point analysis, which is something that South Carolina is doing and most jurisdictions across the country are doing gives us a very clear picture that while there are clearly front-end disparities from the reports to the CPS hotline, the disparities continue throughout the system, through at each decision point, all the way from report to removal to placement to length of stay and so forth. So we see that disparity at those decision points. I think that it is a national issue. There's no jurisdiction that I'm aware of that does not have a problem with racial disproportionality and racial disparity. Some of it is nuanced by region, depending upon the populations. We see across the country the highest disproportionality for Black African-American children and for Native American children, our tribal brothers and sisters, our tribal families. So that's where we see the huge disparities. But regionally, we see them in Hispanic populations, and certainly with the increase in undocumented children, we're seeing a rise disparity rates for those populations as well, especially at the border states. But as the immigration numbers rise, we're seeing the impact on children as well. So we see some disparities there.
So Lyman, I'm glad you brought up the regional discussion. I know Director Leach came from another jurisdiction and you're on the West Coast. What does the data reflect in certain parts of the country from what you're aware of? And I know just from a racial conversation perspective, many in our listening audience may feel that it's a Southern thing. It's a Southern problem, and that's where those disparities lie. But you all are from different jurisdictions. Have you seen similar data in other places where you've worked before?
Yeah, absolutely. As I mentioned earlier, every jurisdiction has a struggle with disparities. Every state in the nation struggles with Black African-American disparities. Many have other regional nuances. So I kind of go back to the historic quote that if you live below the Canadian border, you're in the South. Racial disparities, racial disproportionality is not a Southern state phenomenon. Okay. It's a national phenomenon. So I work primarily in South Carolina and Illinois. And so the disparity rates for African-American children in Illinois, very similar, if not in some cases, more pronounced than in South Carolina. And again, it depends upon the region and what the data shows. So I think that it's important for us to not try to deflect the question or project it onto a particular region or a particular population. It's important to analyze the data, make sure that we're disaggregating by race and ethnicity. It's something that South Carolina is currently doing and getting better at, but continuing to do that and not looking at it as a question of blame or defensiveness, but what are we going to be responsible for? It's what Director Leach was saying, this notion of innovation. What are we going to do differently? It's an age-old problem. And so I think it is the question needs to be, okay, how are we going to change practice? How are we going to change mindsets? How are we going to change some of the structural issues that child welfare presents in mitigating and ultimately eliminating the disproportionality and disparities?
That's great. Director Leach, from the jurisdictions where you've served, sir.
Same with Lyman. I came from a state, Tennessee, where there was data around this, research done through Chapin Hall to show the whole state, but then different parts of the state where you saw more disproportionality of certain populations. It is something that I've been doing this work since 2006, and mm-hmm. we started seeing that data around that time. And it's, I think, incumbent on the state to sit down and go, what do we need to do? What is going on? What is happening with this? Sort of continuous quality work, like understanding, figuring out what strategies you need to put in place. Sometimes there's other things that are presented in front of you, though, within the child welfare space, crises, other things that someone could put this stuff back as a further down priority. And again, it's something that I think is more recently taught within child welfare, that there is a history and the child welfare system, how it's built and developed. But in the past, that wasn't there. As a young child welfare professional, I didn't know these things. Now, as a maybe a more seasoned child welfare professional, you're understanding how the system works, how it doesn't work, what you could do to address it while you're working in the system. And we know more. We learn more. As more research comes out in this work, you sit down and you go, oh my gosh, maybe we're doing things wrong for years and years and years. And it's our opportunity now that we know better to do something different.
That's great. let's delve a little bit deeper into this conversation, gentlemen. Talk a little bit about racial bias and the role that racial bias plays in disparities. How does bias impact decision-making? Lyman, you talked about decision-making at various points throughout the case management process. How does bias, or what role does bias play in decision-making at those various points that a case manager and a supervisor makes decisions about individuals and families? How impactful is that information and those decisions that they're making on those families?
Good question. I think it's bigger than that. I think that we need to recognize that the system itself is biased. And so we can certainly talk about the individual caseworker supervisor level and how we cultivate better decision making, but also recognizing that the system is actually doing what it's designed to do. It's based on a history of rescuing these poor, hurt children from these bad families and using family separation as the means for protecting those children, removing them from their families. There's also a historical context that Director Leach touched on a moment ago that we need to understand our history, dehumanization in this country, that certain populations have come into the child welfare system at different points in time and for different reasons. Historically, really up until the mid-20th century, African-American families were not in the child welfare system. They weren't seen as, they just weren't part of it until certain funding structures changed and then African-American children were brought into the system. And so understanding that, the identities that we create for populations, the notion that we think about deservedness, what our perception of functional family is, what healthy parenting is, all of these things have cultural contexts that ultimately lead to systems bias. I do think that there's work to do at the individual level around narratives. What narratives do we believe about certain populations? What narratives do we believe about children and families? And a perfect example is even the work happening in South Carolina, what we believe about relative caregivers. And so changing mindsets and perceptions about that. From the perspective of individual bias, I think there's some work to do there. And we need to figure out how to spend a little bit more time in self-reflection, spending a little bit more time doing kind of mirror work, getting ourselves in front of the mirror and asking ourselves why we believe certain things, why we believe certain things about certain people, and not trying to externalize those problems. With respect to the system bias, we have to figure out where those mechanisms are. What are the drivers of the disproportionality? What brings children of color into the system at higher rates? What are those policy and practice things that we actually have control over that we can change? One of the recent efforts is to really rethink our definition of neglect. The highest number of kids coming into care are children who are being reported for neglect issues. If you have more exposure to poverty-related issues, you're more likely to be brought to the attention of the system because of neglect. So what's our thinking about that? What's our statutory language say? How are those decisions made? How does that both reflect systems bias, but also the narrative bias that we have about certain populations? So we're seeing that play out with African-American communities, certainly with tribal communities and what we believe about tribes and their sovereignty and their ability to, the way they raise their children, how they raise their children. Then incumbent on us to figure out what the right strategies are to shift that thinking, to shift those narratives. I do think that narrative is a big one in this. And so one of the solutions has got to be reframing some of these narratives that exist today. And one of those most powerful narratives is this rescue narrative that we're on this noble, and it is noble. It is noble to keep children safe. I'm not suggesting otherwise. But when we solely focused on that and use the family separation as the method for keeping those children safe, I think we need to rethink that.
Great comments, Lyman. Director Leach, I know you operate on a macro level. What are your comments when it comes to racial biases on that macro level when you're looking at the entire system?
I think we're looking at the data and then we're looking at what things are, again, going back to decision points. That racial bias, I think, plays a significant role in contributing to disparities. You go down the list, reporting and referral. I think there's bias that affects who gets reported to the system. There might be folks with racial or ethnic backgrounds who are more likely to be reported based on stereotypes or cultural misunderstandings, things like that. investigations and assessment. So the next step, I think there could be bias within how our child welfare professionals maybe conduct their investigations. Decision points with courts and the department as far as removal, length of time in care, likelihood of reunification. Bias can contribute to lack of consideration of those things moving more quickly or, again, the separation or not. I think it does play a role. Lyman mentioned the data. We had about 68,000 calls come into our intake hotline last year. And 55% of those, or about 37,000, were screened in. They met the statute for an investigation. Now, it used to be 65%. So we have seen a decrease to 55%. It's still above the national average, but we are working the right way. And out of that 55%, you know, we know that about 20% of those actually were indicated for child abuse and neglect, right? Now, that was around 26, 27%. So now we've seen it reduced to 20%. And those things in sort of universally, that practice change and the policy change that leads to those things does, again, assist with decreasing disproportionality, but it still exists with that. You have to figure out how to be more targeted with that. And again, that's where the bias comes in. How do you educate folks, create cultural competence, making sure your policies have a strong equity lens to it with those things. And going back to, again, Lyman's point, our three major maltreatment types are physical neglect, the substantial risk of physical or mental injury, and then physical abuse at only 13%. So 43% are physical neglect. And we also know within those 68,000 calls, if 55% are screened in, then 45% are screened out. And they don't lead to anything outside of potentially families needing additional support and help and resources. And so we talk about over-reporting as something we need to look at as well. We have to understand that bias plays a part in these things, but we have to figure out how we mitigate that, address it, try to make sure that that's not part of these decisions.
Appreciate you sharing that data with us. Again, this is not based upon opinion, this discussion, this conversation, but it's based upon facts, factual information that we work in each and every day. Have you guys noticed any disparities between Black and brown families as opposed to their white counterparts in their ability to access needed services to address some of the things that they're needing to fortify and strengthen their families?
Dr. James, I just want to make a couple of points about.
Please.
I was trying to jump in, but I think it's really important to understand why people call the hotline. And most people call the hotline for well-intended reasons. They're not calling to harm children. They're calling to help children, help families. So as long as the system only has one option, which is a hotline call to get families assistance or supports or whatever, then that's what's going to be used, and that triggers the investigation rather than support. So we've talked a lot nationwide, and we've talked about it in South Carolina, creating alternative mechanisms for getting supports to families that are struggling with either poverty-related issues or some kind of neglect issue that doesn't rise to the level of physical abuse and doesn't rise to the level of some of needing to remove a child from the family. I think the other piece of that is most people who make hotline calls don't understand the unintended consequences of what that leads to. So we do have to elevate the narrative of the traumatic impact of removing a child from their family and then the subsequent trauma that children and families experience within the child welfare system, within the child protection system. So the experience of an investigation, the experience of family separation, the experience of what it takes to get your child back or the child's experience in care. So all of those things need to be contemplated as we think about solutions. So just to share that, I think, because that's part of the narrative that we need to think about.
I agree, Lyman, and thank you for bringing attention to that, because there's lasting traumatic impact anytime we get involved Absolutely. In someone's life. Using the hotline as the only resource, we need to look at that. We need to look at other opportunities, other options, other alternatives, so to speak, other than having to call DSS for everything related to children and families.
So thank you for letting me insert that, Director Leach's comments, which were really important. And I think it is making sure that we bring the right context into this space. So every system that touches children and families struggles with disparities, right?
Yes.
So systems that are designed to help, whether it's the mental health, behavioral health system, the housing finance systems, all of those systems struggle with disparities. So I think that there is something there about the fact that populations of color don't get the same access to resources and supports that white populations do in this country. So it has to be broken down better than that simple statement. Okay. It has to be broken down by data. We've done some work at the foundation using what we call community opportunity maps to see what kind of resources are available in communities, sometimes by zip code or county level. How can we assess what resources are available? We know that in states like South Carolina that have large rural populations,
yes, we do,
that resources are not available in the rural areas as much as they are in the kind of urban centers. So understanding where those resources are and where the lack of resources are and how we can build those in. But I think that there's a real need to understand that dynamic better and not just operate on the assumption that there is equitable access to resources and understanding too what those resources are. One of the things that we've worked on, and it's absolutely happening right now in South Carolina, is making sure we're hearing from the users of the system. What do the voices of the families tell us? What are we inquiring of them? What are they sharing with us about what they need, what their experience was, what their neighborhoods and communities are like when it comes to the kind of resources that we're talking about that support healthy families, that support healing and well-being? And so while I don't have a really good scientific answer to that question, I know it's real and we have to go deeper on assessing, you know, what's available to these families.
That's great. Director Leach, your thoughts on access to care for everyone?
I think we have a problem in South Carolina around the number of services and supports for all families in general. You have factors, many factors that play into that. I think parents want what's best for their children. They strive for nurturing environments where kids can flourish. Listen, I'm a parent. It's hard. Navigating parenthood is challenging, and there's a lot of circumstances that can be daunting, but financial hardships, mental health issues, lack of support networks, and these factors constrain even the most dedicated parent, and we see it every day. There is a lack of mental health services. There's a lack of services for children and families with intellectual disabilities in the state. Wraparound services with the goal of family preservation and addressing the risk of child safety, but also making sure that we provide passionate and supportive approach around the family. How do we strengthen the family? Those things are lacking, and we know that. Now, I think there is a lot of people in the state who are working towards building those service array, system of care type. And what it does when you don't have that is, again, you have families who get involved with the child welfare system that potentially would not have in the first place. And I think that understanding the need by listening to our constituents, the folks who are needing the services or getting the services, and at the same time, really working towards building something that isn't just we have everything, but it's got to be equitable. It's got to be in rural areas. We have a lot of barriers to those things, but we have to keep working through that. A lot of work to be done in that area to make sure that there is satisfactory and necessary services for folks.
Great response, sir. Thank you so much. Earlier, we talked about bias and its impact at certain decision points during the case management process. How do racial disparities manifest themselves in the work of case managers and team leaders, those individuals, those supervisors that work with case managers, with their engagement with Black and Brown families? Have you noticed any disparities in between how certain case managers and team leaders treat families of color as opposed to other families?
I'm sure there is bias. There's implicit bias, explicit bias. I think it's incumbent upon us to make sure we educate our professionals in understanding the history of the child welfare system and that there are disproportionalities in the system and why we think they are in the system. I think that helps. We also need to make sure that we provide the appropriate trainings around, you know, bias and then cultural competence and then understanding the data behind all this. I think that's important. It leads to a stronger workforce, more compassionate, understanding workforce. I think that the whole system has lots of opportunity to do better and learn more in this area. I think we have a lot of work to do just in general about the idea that we're designed to step in when a child's safety and well-being are at risk, but also we need to be that safety net and support mechanisms for families in need. And that's not always the reality or aligned with that ideal. A lot of times people think we're here to take children. No, I mean, the idea is how to strengthen the family upstream so that they don't have to get to us, all families. And so we have to keep pushing that narrative that we can strengthen families. We can find the resources. We can figure out what's needed. We can handle that so that, again, we're not getting to the point where there's a crisis or they're at risk to have to come into care. That would be preferable.
Lyman, from your perspective, is there a challenge with engagement with Black and Brown families?
It's a good question, and I'm not quite sure I'm going to answer it directly, because I think what I see more often than not is a culture in a child welfare, child protection system. I definitely see it in South Carolina and in other jurisdictions where I've worked, where there's more a culture of fear, a culture that is more related to making the harshest decision for fear of being criticized, sued, whatever. And so I think that that's something, again, South Carolina's out in front of that conversation, being part of the National Partnership on Child Safety, which is focused on safety science. So it's creating an environment where workers feel okay making decisions that may not be removal or keeping a child in care. And so I think that there's something there that absolutely connects with the supervisor child welfare, the social worker dynamic. So there is a coaching aspect to that. There's certainly a collective responsibility in making the best decisions for the children and families. I say that because we see the same level of disparities in terms of decision-making, despite the ethnicity of the worker. That's why I think it's much more of a systemic issue, much more of a practice-related issue, and much more of a organizational culture dynamic than it is bias at that individual worker. So there's some bias out there. Individuals do have bias. I'm not disputing that at all. But I think from a systemic perspective, we can mitigate that by putting in the right mechanisms, the right practices. That's certainly happening in South Carolina. How do those practices make sure that they're ensure that there's an equity lens in the decision making, and that that is managed to so that the supervisors are coaching and managing to those kind of equitable expectations? I think that is an important question. I think what I see is that it's a little bit too easy to kind of point to individual bias and make that assumption. And so I just would say that we can work on individual bias. We can do awareness building, relationship building, coaching, and all of those things happening. And I think it's really important to focus on the practice and policy. And beyond that, who else is involved in the decision making? So no child comes out of care without the signature of a judge. How do we engage the legal community? How do we ensure legal representation? What is our partnership with the judiciary and the folks that are making those legal decisions? And there's a lot of work happening across the country in that arena as well.
So you mentioned something. You mentioned fear. And I know growing up in an African-American community, there were many individuals within our space that really feared their children being taken away from. Talk to members of tribal communities, and they have that very same fear. Where do you think that fear comes from? Where does that fear originate for these communities? And is that a legitimate fear, or is it something that's overblown?
No, it's absolutely a legitimate fear. I mean, I think that many communities, especially communities of color, are more afraid of the child protection system than they are law enforcement. Law enforcement can come and arrest me, but child protection can come and take my child from me. And so there are communities out there that I think have experienced child protection more as family separation. And so there is a legitimate fear that goes back to our historic narrative, our historic focus in child welfare, where the mechanism we have to ensure a child's safety is to remove them from their family and not paying enough attention to the trauma that's associated with that action. I think, again, the conversation has got to be about supporting families, making sure that they have the right resources, the right supports, focusing on neglect language, and are we providing the right services up front? Is it incumbent on child protection to be involved with these families, or are there other ways to get those services and supports? what we've seen across the country is that child protection should have a very small role in this conversation. Child protection should be much smaller than it is. Things get piled on top of child protection, and then it becomes this bigger child welfare context. So then child protection not only becomes responsible for that initial safety call, that initial issue of child safety, but now they're required to add this whole laundry list of things that the family has to do in order to get their child back or be responsible for well-being supports that should come from other parts of the system, other parts of the community. So we haven't done a good job of kind of showing what the fundamental role of child protection is within a context of a broader child welfare system. But how else can we get well-being and healing supports to families without a call to the CPS hotline, without an investigation, without a removal? And so I think that's a big part of the conversation too. Again, that we're excited to be in with South Carolina as this is growing and we're getting better. Let me make this point too, sorry, because one of the struggles in the conversation around racism and racial disparity is that we somehow think we've solved the problem. We get to these places where we think racism is a thing of the past or racial disproportionality is a thing of the past. And Director Leach said something earlier, and that is that we are better than we used to be. No question about it.
Yes.
Better. We're seeing a reduction in the number of kids. We're seeing reductions in disparities. We simply haven't arrived yet. One of the things that I encourage folks to do, leaders to consider, is that recognize progress. Absolutely recognize progress. Hold off on celebrating success. Hold off on thinking that we've somehow arrived and become successful in this conversation, while at the same time acknowledging that progress is being made. So I hope that made sense.
It did. Thank you so much. Director Leach, do you want to chime in on fear and some of the ways that you've seen it manifest?
I think Lyman's spot on. We need that cultural shift, one that acknowledges there are inherent struggles of parents, and we need to offer empathy and support rather than judgment. We need to acknowledge that every parent is doing their best. We need to help them feel empowered and supported and respected. And we need to make sure that we are providing upstream, not just the child welfare system, but all the folks ahead of that. Make sure that there are livable wages and there's affordable housing and there are appropriate mental health supports and ability for transportation and all of those things. All of those things lead to less stress as a parent when you have those things, which lead to less abuse and neglect and which lead to less involvement with the system. But the system needs to continue to be proactive and shift its thinking about how removal and supports around children, especially within South Carolina, that 43% of neglect. What does that really mean? How can we help those families?
That's great. So I'd like to shift the conversation just a little bit. So here at I3, as you know, we like to end on innovative ways to improve, innovative ways to help, innovative ways to build our society into a better society. So as we imagine innovative ways to address what we've been discussing, racial disparities, racial bias, what do you think of to address the disproportionalities and disparities that we see in the child welfare system that can help our listening audience really provoke them to think about ways in their own communities that they can address some of these issues? Director Leach, do you want to kick us off with this discussion, sir, on innovative ways?
I think it's not really innovative, but I think talking about it, having the conversation and making sure that the conversation is on the forefront of everything that you're talking about, which includes policy changes, practice changes, training changes, what those things look like, development, equity review, and assessment tool in those aspects, looking at the data, not just once, but over time, looking at it at different decision-making points. Again, maybe on the basic end, but it needs to occur. You have to feel empowered to make that part of your everyday way of looking at the system. Putting in specific implicit bias training, not just for the folks within the child welfare system, but folks who may be calling through mandated reporting and making them aware of that bias that may happen. We see over-reporting in South Carolina all the time by different groups of professionals. And that may be a misinterpretation of misunderstanding of the behavior, not understanding what child abuse and neglect, the laws actually say, maybe suspicions of abuse and neglect that aren't really there. Those things exist and it happens every day and we see it where people call and they didn't need to call. They could have refer to another resource for help. I think, again, the data collection analysis is a big thing. I think that we need to continue to review and assess trends, disparities, areas for improvement. We need to talk about it earlier. We need to come up with trauma-informed practices and prevention and support services that help with poverty. Healthcare, how do we access that? How do we access affordable housing? How do we get those practices in place that are equitable for all families? Listen, I've been doing this work long enough. I've been in this role long enough. It seems like we talk about this stuff over and over, year after year. 10 years ago, we might have been talking about the same thing. At some point, you just have to go, okay, let's keep it simple. Look at what could potentially, through continuous quality improvement lens, what can we change? What strategies? Do we see a difference in the data? Adapt, make those changes again. But you got to keep an eye on it. You got to be aware of it. And you need to talk to families that are involved in the system and hear the harm or the trauma that they're feeling for maybe the length of time they're within the system, the extended period of time that they may be in the system, or the decisions that are being made. They're being made for maybe a Black and brown family that may not be the same decision made for a white family. We got to look at those things and talk about those things. Those are things that I think that just on a regular, everyday thing, we got to be talking about and thinking about.
I agree. I think we overcomplicate the matter every now and then. We need to keep it simple, but we also need to be intentional about having the conversations, but also putting measures in place that mitigate some of the challenges that you've mentioned. Lyman, from your perspective, what's some innovative measures that we as a system or a part of the system can put in place to mitigate some of these challenges that we face and that we've discussed?
Change happens through dialogue and relationship. And I think that Director Leach mentioned creating space for the conversations. How do we talk about it? And I think it is creating brave and safe space for people to have conversations that actually disarm the topic, that recognize that there's kind of a visceral reaction, no matter who you are, when we start talking about racism, racial disproportionality, racial disparities, there's a visceral response to that. So what is that about? And I think part of it is about this kind of blame and defensive dynamic that we get into. And that's the thing that we have to resist, because there's no winning in that. That continues to polarize us in the discussion. So the question for me is, what do we want to be responsible for? What is it that we want to change? And so making sure the conversation is driven by that. So I think that there's ways to facilitate those conversations. There's agreements that can be brought into the space to create the environment so people will engage in those discussions, no matter who they are, from a brave and safe space, right? I think that expanding our interactions with the voice of lived expertise is incredibly important in this. And it's something that is growing across the country. It's growing in South Carolina, but even going deeper, making sure that we're in communities, in neighborhoods, hearing from the voices of those who are impacted. I talked about communities that are afraid of CPS, but my perspective is from the periphery. I'm not in that community, right? So it's really getting into the community, be clear about that and not, you know, take Lyman's word for it, but how is it that we connect with the families that are being impacted by those systems and hearing from them genuinely about what they think would be helpful, and then thinking about it from that perspective. I think that there's a real need to understand history. In this day and age, that's a tough one to say, but there's a question about history, which is, I don't want to go into that, but we need to understand how we got where we are. History is not the past, it's the prologue. It tells us how we got where we are. How did this child welfare system evolve from this kind of rescue mentality that's gotten us to where we are? How have populations entered child welfare at different places? What is the trauma that the child welfare system has caused? Do we understand the boarding school dynamic with our tribal brothers and sisters? Do we understand the orphan trains? Do we understand the moment from complete exclusion for African-American families to almost overnight over-inclusion in the child welfare system? So we're in the mid-20th century. So do we understand those complexities? What are the narratives that drive decision making? You know, do we have narratives that create identities for certain populations? We're certainly struggling with the immigration issues in this country right now, and largely it's populations of color that we're concerned about at the southern border. We don't have these conversations about the Canadian border, but we are having them about the southern border. So there's this whole context of brown people coming across the border and how we're responding to that. So for us, we have to make sure we're paying attention to the children and the impact on the children. I think that there's also a, let me end with these two thoughts. One is, how do we frame this issue? For me, I've been doing a lot of work on this notion of well-being and a much broader multi-system, multi-context perspective, life course perspective of well-being. I believe that racial equity is a well-being domain. Understanding the traumatic impact of a racialized system, of racial disproportionality, understanding that trauma, and then getting more into the focus on healing from that and making sure that we're mitigating the trauma. I said two things, didn't I? Oh, it's about narratives. What's the narrative that we really want to promote? Can we talk about a narrative? And this is something that I think child welfare struggles with. Can we put out a proactive, forward-thinking, visionary narrative about what child welfare ought to be? Mm-hmm. That's the conversation that we're having at KC Family Programs, jurisdictions across the country. We're almost a quarter of the way through the 21st century, and we're still operating on 19th and 20th century practices and principles. What is the 21st century child welfare, child well-being? I call it child well-being. What is the 21st century child well-being system we really want to create? There's some opportunities in South Carolina with Doris Duke Foundation coming to talk about prevention work, work that you all are doing in Thriving Families Safer Children, the work with the National Partnership on Child Safety. All of those things can contribute to that. And what does that lead us to in terms of the narrative of the future of child welfare that we're trying to create in the great state of South Carolina? So I think that's part of the innovation that has to happen. People have to see a different future, drive towards, rather than simply doing practice that they've been trained to do, and the practices outlined that's in right. your policies and your practice manuals in the state statute. So I think that's part of it. And then creating a proactive communication strategy around that vision. That's not going to happen tomorrow, but it can start tomorrow.
We can begin tomorrow, though, but we have to start. We have to begin. So historically, this type of conversation has been very polarizing, but I think our audience can feel your passion. They can feel your heart. And the fact that you are sincere and you're genuine about ensuring that children, youth, and families are treated fairly across the board, not approaching it from a blaming or pointing fingers perspective, but one that's genuine, one that really has our constituents, our clients, our fellow human beings at the heart of the matter. So I applaud you for that. Are there any last words, Director Leach, that you want to share with our listening audience?
It's a journey, Lyman sort of alluded to. And it's a journey where we're all learning and hopefully improving our systems, our policy, our practice as we see what these systems have done and are doing to families. I want stronger families, healthier families within South Carolina. That leads to all kinds of benefits for the state. There are ways to do it outside of potentially separating families. There are ways to do it where we can affect change upstream, which is going to actually not cost as much money. There's just so many benefits to that. And Lyman's right. I think the discussions and the things that we're talking about and thinking about really are what the future is. It's a journey and it takes a long time. But the data is what the data is. We got to keep just going back to that and going, hey, we are doing really well in these metrics. We're not doing so well in these metrics. What are things we're going to put in place? How do we keep grinding and moving and battling and fighting to improve this work for folks that we serve? It doesn't ever end. It is something that you wake up every day and you go, I have to give 100%. I have to give my best. I have to make sure that I'm thinking about now and in the future. 5 years in the future, 10 years in the future, what's going to benefit families? What decisions are we making that are going to affect them, hopefully in a positive way? Whether that stuff we introduce, thinking about statute changes or regulation changes or any of those things. I'm thinking about now, but I'm also thinking about 5 or 10 years from now, because my decisions can affect people negatively or positively, each one I make. Having the data, understanding where we're doing well and where we're not doing well or where we can improve is key to making those decisions for the future.
Lyman, any lasting thoughts for our audience, sir?
Let me first say that I applaud both of you for your passion and your investment in children and families in the great state of South Carolina and your contributions to child welfare in general. I also applaud all of the folks that are working on behalf of children and families in South Carolina. I know of nobody that goes into this business for the wrong reasons. Nobody goes into this business to harm children. And we can get better. We can solve these problems. These problems are solvable. They're not intractable. They can be solved. I think if we work together collectively, if we focus on why we are in this, what is the intrinsic motivator that brought us into this work? How do we tap into that with all the people from the courts to the legal teams to the social workers to the providers in the community to the communities themselves, the communities that are supporting these families themselves? How do we tap into those intrinsic motivators? And what do we believe about children? I heard Marion Wright Edelman, who founded the Children's Defense Fund, say years ago, if you don't love children, go do something else. So let's focus on what we believe about children, why we're in this work. And that will help us get to the solution. It will help us, the solutions that will help us resist the polarities, the things that pull us away. It will help us resist the discomfort that we're going to experience in these conversations and really get us to a place where we can identify solutions. I believe that racial disproportionality can be eliminated. Disparities can be eliminated. And we can do that. And we just have to be intentional about it and understand what the right strategies and the right tactics are and get people motivated in that space. So I'm excited for the future of South Carolina. I know you're involved in these conversations. I also understand that it's an interesting environment that we're in right now with a lot of political polarity, a lot of charged language around this. And so I think for us, we have to really center our attention and our gaze on the children. What's best for the children? What's best for the families? Resist the pulls to the right or left or whatever the pulls are. Really center our focus on what's best for the children and families.
That's great. Gentlemen, thank you so much for bringing your wisdom, your passion, your compassion to this conversation. It's what's needed, having the conversation, but also putting steps in place to minimize the chances that there are racial disparities, chances that bias continues. And that will not happen unless we're intentional about the work that we do. As Director Leach mentioned earlier, we have to keep an eye on it. We have to keep an eye on it, not focus on that solely. We cannot not pay attention to it. Thank you both. I appreciate you, and thank you for joining me on i3.
Thank you.
My pleasure and privilege. Thanks for the invitation.
Thank you for joining us today on our i3 podcast. If you've enjoyed what you've heard, please follow and subscribe to the show. And until next time, remember to make time during the day to imagine the possibilities of how you can improve the work that you do. Write down your ideas so that they become goals to strive for. And lastly, begin to engage in critical thinking about how you can implement your ideas through groundbreaking, innovative ways as we work together to improve the world in which we live.